Welcome to MTG Pro Tutor, your gathering of insights, tips, and advice from renowned players and community icons. Connect with venerated teachers to gain the knowledge you need to improve your skills. Now, here's your planar guide and personal tutor, Sean Penrod.
Hello and welcome to episode 183 of the MTG Pro Tutor Podcast. Sean Penner, your host here. So happy that you are joining me today. We have a fantastic guest lined up for you like we do twice a week, every single week. Here on the show, the goal is to help 1,000 players qualify for the Pro Tour. And one of the ways that we do that is by bringing on Grand Prix Top 8s and Pro Tour Top 16s. So the best players in the world to talk about their beginnings with Magic, how they prepare for events, and dive into what they're doing and what they're thinking so we can improve our thought processes and skills, all with the end goal of making it to the Pro Tour. But before we dive into the nitty-gritty details with our amazing guest today, I do want to say thank you to the patrons. You mean the world to me. I am so grateful for your support. Because of you, we're able to do things like hire out the show notes, hire out the editing, and keep me focused on finding great guests, honing my interview skills, and really bringing out the best of our guests. So thank you, patrons, so much. If you are interested in becoming a patron, you can go to mtgpro2.com/Patreon to check that out. And as a thank you, each and every month, I do a giveaway to the patrons. So if you want to be entered in that as well, go to mtgpro2.com/Patreon. Now, it's an exciting time in Magic as far as product goes right now. Modern Masters 2017 is upon us. So if you're lucky enough to do a limited event or get some product in the near future, congratulations. That's awesome. There's some really good stuff in there. And you're more than welcome to post your sweet pulls in the Facebook group, as well as ask us for advice on your sealed pool or draft archetype, whatever you have going on there. So, but that's enough of the top of the interview stuff. We have a great guest, like I alluded to, so let's bring him in, sit down, and talk about Magic. What's up, everybody? I am super, super excited to have our guest with us today. Our guest is the champion of Merfolk. He made top 8 at Grand Prix Vancouver, while his followers, Jamik Nasinski and Simon Slutsky, won GP Copenhagen 2015 and GP Los Angeles 2016 with Merfolk. Merfolk has been scrubbed off as a joke by the top players for years. It is our guest's mission to prove them wrong again. Coming to us from Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, prodigies near and far, let's welcome the one, the only, the Merfolk master himself, Jonathan Nikichu Zacek. Jonathan, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Today is amazing. Last week, the tournament at the Grand Prix was amazing. I feel completely, you know, I'm on cloud 9. Everyone's happy. The Merfolk community is up in arms, and they should be because we know we're making Merfolk great again.
Love it. Absolutely love it. Are you ready to delve into your mind and share with the audience tips and tricks to take their game to the next level?
Absolutely. That's what I'm here for. That's what I've been trying to do for a very long time. You know, there's a very funny aspect about Magic is that there is no theory on this game, like almost none at all. I'm a chess master and a former professional poker player, and there's tons of in those games. There's books about theory and strategy that you can learn. And in Magic, there's almost nothing. You know, there are deck techs and stuff like that, but that doesn't exactly teach you how to actually play the game. So, you know, whenever I have an opportunity, you know, I try to actually piece together how this game is actually played. And I'm more than willing to help share that with your viewers.
Ooh, I love that. Definitely looking forward to diving into that a little bit more. Prodigies out there, as a reminder, if you want to connect with Jonathan, the best place to do that is online. Obviously, he's on Twitter at NikichuMTG and also has a Facebook as well. So you can find him there. Say thanks for being on the show. Ask him a question. He also runs and hosts the Nikichu MTG YouTube channel where, you know, he puts out video content, obviously, and mostly about Merfolk, and you can follow him there as well. So connect with Jonathan and learn about Magic. So Jonathan, are you born and raised in Winnipeg?
Yeah, I am. This Arctic wasteland, the middle of nowhere. Everything is incredibly far away from the city. If no one knows where it is, it's like the center of Canada, but a little bit above the border of the United States. And just a few years ago, we were colder than Mars. We were an internet sensation for like a few days.
Just the way you say that, it sounds really, really cold. I don't know how cold Mars is, but if you're colder than that.
Incredibly. Well, it gets minus 40 degrees Celsius, which is minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit on a regular basis every single year.
Wow. That's crazy. Okay, yeah, so really cold, really cold. And being out there in the middle of nowhere, as you call it, we would love to know your origin story. Like, how did you come into Magic? Tell us the very first time you ever saw or played with Magic cards.
So I was playing the Pokemon trading card game when I was 13 years old. This was around 1999. And I was pretty proficient at this game just by, like, winning flawlessly over and over and over again in local tournaments. I got into the top 100 rated players of the world. The game was very easy because the 99% of my competition were just kids and parents that had no clue about the strategy to the game. My friends, however, started to abandon the Pokemon trading card game, and they are moving on to Magic the Gathering, the adult version of the Pokemon trading card game. And so they were trying to sucker me into this thing, and I tried to play, and you know, they taught me how to block, and then they attacked me with shadow creatures, and then they taught me how to cast spells, and then they countered them, and I said, this game is stupid. I'm not playing this game. This thing is awful. And all the cards were ugly. The art was just terrible. It was just obscene to my eyes. So I said, I'm abandoning this game. I'm not playing this. This is not for me. But anyway, on the way back from one of my Pokemon trading card game tournaments, my friends were playing in a Magic tournament. So I go spectate the thing. I have no idea what's going on. But lo and behold, there is a young man named Jason Howden playing this mono blue permission deck with a card called the Thieving Magpie from Urza's Destiny. And if anyone would look that card up, they would see that this is the most cutest, most beautiful picture in all of Magic. It is this image of this magpie that is stealing jewels on the birch of a tree. I thought it was absolutely gorgeous. And I said, okay, I am going to make a deck based around this thing. And basically it was like four Thieving Magpie and a million counter spells. My friends were like, well, blue counters things. I'm like, all right. So I got all the Force of Wills and Dazes and Counterspell and Forbid, Dismiss. And my only win condition was this Thieving Magpie. and that's how I started. And I played some standard tournaments. I mean, I net decked. But anyway, that's the story of how I got actually into the game. And I've been still very devoted to mono blue since then.
Wow. Excellent. That's really neat. So that very first set that your friends got you in on, what was that? What was that first set of yours?
Well, the standard at the time was Masks and Invasion Block, but Thieving Magpie came from Urza's Destiny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember. That's so fun. Just the other day, we were visiting my wife's aunt, and they had magpies in the backyard, and I was like, Thieving Magpie, you know, Thieving Magpie. Every time I see one, I know what it looks like because of Magic. Like, that's the reason why I know what a magpie looks like, because when I was a kid, I saw that card, and yeah, it is, that is a nice piece of art, so that's awesome. So, Mercadian Masks back then. Since then, what's been your favorite set?
Favorite set? Oh, wow. I don't think I've ever been asked or thought about that question, but my favorite set probably is... maybe Theros, because Thieving Magpie used to be my favorite card, but then it got completely trumped by this Master of Waves. And that whole block, I had a lot of fun with that block. That Theros brought me like Thassa, Master of Waves, and created this stupid mono blue devotion deck that ended up being incredibly competitive throughout the entire standard season. So that's probably Theros. If I had to give a... just throw something out there immediately.
I mean, that was a perfect, you know, magpie tail into, see what I did there, into what is your favorite card, which I think you just mentioned is Master of Waves. Is that right?
Yes. Now that is now officially my favorite card. That card brings so much pain to my opponent's faces. It's hilarious because it costs 4 mana. It's a 2/1 creature. But they can't kill it. They can't do anything about it. It's usually spelling absolute disaster for my opponents. And when it wins big, it wins like in a catastrophic manner. In Modern, people are usually just trying to win with like these 4/5 or 5/6 Tarmogoyfs, or, you know, relatively big creatures. But Master Waves can help kill for like 24 damage.
Nice. And how is that? For those of us who don't know, what does it do? What is it? And yeah.
Master of Waves, 1 blue, 3 colorless, a 2/1 merfolk wizard. It has protection from red. It gives all my elementals +1/+1, and when it enters the battlefield, I get a 1/0 blue elemental token equal to my devotion to blue, which means I get a 1/0 elemental equal to all the blue mana symbols on my permanence. So if I have a Master of Waves and a Lord of Atlantis in play, those are 3 blue mana symbols, and I will get 3 1/0 tokens, which become 2/1 elementals because Master of Waves gives all my elementals +1/+1.
Excellent. Okay, nice. And so how are you able to punch through these big, you know, 4 or 5 Tarmogoyfs and stuff like that?
Well, there's multiple ways with merfolk. I mean, you can play Tidebinder Mage, you know, tap their $150 card with my 50 cent card. You can, which Tidebinder Mage, when it's a 2/2 blue merfolk wizard, when it enters the battlefield, tap target red or green creature an opponent controls. It doesn't untap during its controller's untap step, so long as you control Tidebinder Mage. You can go wide with Master of Waves, play, get a Master of Waves in play and have a million tokens. I can kill them still with Dismember. I play with Relic of Progenitus, which can empty the graveyards and turn the Tarmogoyf into like a 0/1 creature. Tarmogoyf is actually a big deal for merfolk. It's a pretty big body. It outclasses all my other little dinky creatures, so I have to have a lot of answers for it. Otherwise, I'll get nullified by it.
But that's awesome. I love how you just walk through that you do have the answers and you thought about it, and there's different angles that you can take. You know, the tapper, the graveyard exile, going wide and just going around it. And like, that's awesome. You know, I absolutely love the thought and, you know, preparation and just the experience that obviously you're showing. So that's awesome. That's really cool.
And it's really important. I'm a real big proponent of having cards that are flexible against a lot of other decks. So when we talk about Master of Waves, it's good against any deck with a lot of red removal. It's good against Burn because I can just stone block all their creatures for the rest of the game. It's good against all sorts of control decks because it's a one threat, like it's a massive one threat that can't be killed by any of their red removal, which is the most popular removal in Modern. It can go wide against a lot of creature decks or stabilize the board against a lot of big creature decks. Now, we talk about Tidebinder Mage. Tidebinder Mage is great against Burn. It's great against any decks with mana dorks to tap them down. It's great against any sort of green mid-range creature deck. It's even good against one of my worst enemies, Elves, which is really, really fast. We can cut them off down on mana. But yeah, mana dorks are part of tons of decks, so that nullifies those. And then Relic of Progenitus, the graveyard is used by tons of decks, by Snapcaster Mage decks, by Dredge, by combo decks like Goryeo's Vengeance. And there's also tons of Tarmogoyf decks, or any decks with Lingering Soul. So Relic of Progenitus plays a part not only against Tarmogoyf, but against a lot of other different ranges of decks and cards. So I really like cards that I can use against a lot of different decks. I don't like to have these sort of cards that are good against only one deck and I can't bring it in against anything else. I find that's a waste of sideboard slots.
Love it. That's a really, really good point. Now, you mentioned earlier the breadth of experience you have in, you know, other areas like chess and whatnot and poker. What makes Magic fun for you? Like, why have you stuck with it, you know, ever since you got dragged in by the Thieving Magpie? Why are you stuck around? What makes it fun?
The fact that the game changes. Every single set changes the entire game, and as new cards enter the playing pool, it keeps it unique and fresh. Like, for example, you know, a new set comes out, and now Fatal Push is now a card, and it can get added to Jund, and it gave some more life to Abzan, and so we're seeing new Abzan decks, or we're seeing old Abzan decks come back to life. So there's a lot of variety, and now people are trying to make these expertise, cheat Emrakul into play with expertise decks. So every single set brings a new sense of novelty to the game, and it keeps it fresh, entertaining, and exciting, and more dynamic.
Totally agree. I love that. Absolutely love that. And when you started getting serious about Magic, what was an aspect that you were terrible at, but that you eventually overcame?
That is a good question. What was a hurdle for me? Difficult to think. Maybe it was just the people around me. Like when I just started taking this game very seriously maybe 3 years ago, because I played from 1999 to about 2000, then I dumped it. Then I came back around 2010, around the Zendikar area, and I wasn't playing very well, and then I dumped it. And then at some point I said, you know, I'm taking this game very seriously. But I was just sort of fortunate and lucky to be just around the right people. Whenever you want to be serious at a game, you have to reach out to very strong players. And that's what I did when I was playing chess, when I was playing poker. But I guess I never was active in doing that with Magic the Gathering. And I just so happened to start playing in, taking the game up again when I was living in Warsaw, Poland. And they actually, oddly enough, had an incredibly strong tournament scene. They were very competent, great players that do end up playing on the Pro Tour. So I ended up being good friends with them, and I fed off them incredibly quickly, and that helped bolster my game. Whereas in the past, I didn't know who was very good, and I didn't try very hard to associate myself with anyone who was very strong. So I would say that was probably the biggest influence between, you know, me being just some random scrub and becoming a very, very proficient player.
Excellent. So how can we find those good players that we can rub shoulders with and play with and improve with?
Well, yeah, well, you have to look at the results. I mean, there's a lot of good players that are still unknown. But, you know, if there is certain players in your around your local game store just consistently winning over and over and over again, you want to be listening to their opinion more than other people's. You know, everyone has an opinion in Magic, but it's very hard to tell who's actually literally winning versus other people, because we judge people based on their Planeswalker points and not an Elo system or anything like that. Well, you know, what I'm saying is that, you know, you could play 30 tournaments, scrub out of them 29 times and just, you know, make top eight once. But that doesn't necessarily make you a good player. You could have just got there by luck. But whoever's consistently getting there, you want to be paying attention to them more often than to taking the advice from people who are not, basically. You know, it's sort of information selection. When I was learning poker, everyone had an opinion online, but I just filtered out everyone's opinion except for a few people that I knew were winning on the internet. Like they had solid results. They were consistently posting very good graphs. There was like databases online showing people who were winning and losing. And so I just focused on all the advice that was being offered by the consistently winning players. And so you're just going to have to make a good judgment, you know, who's actually literally winning at this game, and, you know, accept their criticism, whatever they have to offer.
Mm-hmm. Now, you just said something very interesting that I've never thought about before, which is match rankings based on like an Elo system. And I've never thought about that in terms of Magic. How would that work? Everything that your record would have to be logged, you know, kept track of in the database that's shared everywhere. So every time you go to any event, it would match you up with people who have similar skill rankings. Is that right? Because like the Elo system, if I understand it correctly, it keeps track of every single win and loss you've had, and then it matches you up with somebody who has a similar skill rating.
Well, they don't necessarily have to match you up. I mean, it's assuming if the tournament's using that Elo system, which Magic the Gathering doesn't. They rightfully got rid of it.
Oh, they did. They used to have it?
They used to have it. They used to have it years ago. The Elo system was, in my opinion, Elo systems are actually quite bad for the game, because it shows people who it's good for the people who are winning and all that. It gives them encouragement, but it's actually incredibly discouraging to the people who are losing. And not to mention that Magic has an incredible amount of luck, and the ratings can go up and down in wild, drastic ways. However, there is a website out there called mtgeloproject.net. who is taking all the standings from every single Grand Prix and went back, I don't know how far, how many years now, and is creating this Elo database and has compiled, like, I don't know, probably hundreds of tournaments right now to give people an Elo rating. And it shows people, you know, it shows now who are the consistent winners. What I really like is that you can look up someone, for example, like Sam Black, and see how often he's scrubbed out of tournaments. And he's a great player, great top class player. But even players like him, you know, they don't make day two all the time. Back when you had to go X2 to make day two, pros were only making day two half the time, 50%. So 50% of the time, they wouldn't make it. And that's with three buys. With three buys, they wouldn't make it 50% of the time. And when you have no buys, you're like in even worse shape. And also, the database shows that the best players in the world are only winning 66% of the time. That means two out of three games. So if you go 10-5 at a Grand Prix, you're doing great. That was a great result. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing to be like ashamed of with that sort of result, because that's 66%. And the pros, you know, they shun it or whatever. But the reality is, you need to play good and get lucky in order to make these top eights in these Grand Prix, et cetera.
Yeah, man, that's really good. Yeah, I love just talking about that. That's excellent stuff. So, Jonathan, when would you say was your breakthrough as a Magic player?
My breakthrough as a Magic player? Maybe when I started winning PTQs with this Merfolk deck. So I'm not sure. I got like sort of an aha moment. Well, what ended up happening is this. So I'm trying to get into Modern. I played this Bogles deck and I got thrashed really, really badly.
That was my first Modern deck.
You know, that's it's so sad. Everyone's entry level deck into Modern seems to be Bogles, and then I don't know. I like lost 21 games straight because I refused to bring in Path to Exile and Dismember in from my sideboard. But it turns out every single one of my opponents, no matter what deck they were playing, was bringing in Spellskite, and I just got annihilated. So I said, you know, I'm going to get rid of this deck. What other deck can I play in Modern? Because I wanted to just feel out the format before I would switch to Splinter Twin. Because I'm a proponent of playing the Tier 1 decks. I really think you should try to play, you know, the Tier 1 decks. They're strong for a reason. But I needed to feel my way out through the format before I would, like, move to Twin. So I picked up Merfolk because it played the Master of Waves, and it seemed like something that was similar to Mono Blue Devotion, which I was playing in Standard at the time. And I was very lucky to get some advice from Petter Sokerik, who is a top 100 or top 25 player in the world. He happened to, just at the same time that I was interested in Merfolk, give out advice in the MTG Salvation Merfolk forums. And sadly for Petter, the forums disputed with his advice, and they said that he didn't know what he was doing, even though he was playing on the Pro Tour. And this comes back to when I said, like, reach out to the people who are good. And I reached out to him because I saw, hey, this guy's playing on the Pro Tour, and he had a great result with Merfolk on the Pro Tour. This guy knows what he's doing. And I had just very brief conversations with this guy, but he gave me a completely different insight to the deck, and it helped a lot. And it also helped that the correct way, my style of playing Magic, which is sort of patient and careful and cautious, as I used to do when I originally played this Mono Blue Permission Thieving Magpie deck, was very... It was the most effective with Merfolk. Merfolk is not an aggressive, it's not an aggro deck, as it sort of looks like on paper. I play it like a mid-range pseudo-control deck. And I played two PTQs, and I top-8ed both of them. One of them had like a field of 80 people. The other one had a field of 175. And then I started playing this deck online, and I was thrashing people, winning at 80%. And then I realized, well, I don't need to go to Splinter Twin because, you know, the best players in the world are only winning 66% of the time, and I'm winning 80%. So to hell with it, I'm gonna stick to Merfolk.
Nice, yeah.
So that felt like that was the moment that I got good. That's what I would say. And then I just built on that since then.
Excellent. Yeah, that's awesome. I love how, you gravitated towards people who knew what they were talking about and had good opinions. Like Petra Suhudek, he was just on the show 3 episodes ago. He was episode 180. And we had him on the show and got to talk to him. Yeah, really deep mind and great conversation. And so that's really neat that you learned from him and you're able to get these results at these events. And like you said, hey, if a good record is 60% and I'm at 80, then I'll just stick with this. So that's awesome.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, what advice from your Magic mentors, either those you knew in person or you studied under from afar, what advice has really stuck with you?
Well, the advice that stuck with me that stands out that I'm promoting on my channel are things like, for example, you got to play the deck that speaks to you. My Pro Tour friend, Bartek Lewandowski, he, despite the fact that him and his other Pro Tour friend, Peter Vold, agreed that they had some sense that Scapeshift at one time was the best deck in Modern, Bartek just couldn't win with the deck. He was a very, very good player, but he is really a green mage. He's very good with green decks, and he has all his PTQ success with green decks. And, he told me, you got to play the deck that speaks to you, and he decided not to play with Scapeshift just because he couldn't play it as well as Petter did.
So how do you find out what deck speaks to you? What does that look like?
You gotta play test. You gotta try things out, Some people are combo players. They like to assemble this cool combo and then win. But you need a certain mind for that. You need to think about your outs and calculate, what is the most efficient way of getting to those cards that you need. I remember I was playing against an Ad Nauseam opponent in the Grand Prix, and my opponent and his friends were talking afterwards saying, you made a lot of mistakes. You shouldn't play sleight of hand after you scry. You should play sleight of hand, see the top two cards, take one, and then play your scry land. He played like a Temple of Abandon, Temple. He played one of those black blue temples or whatever. He played it first, scryed, saw the top card of his deck, kept it on top, then played sleight of hand to take that card. And his friend said, "No, no, no! You should have played sleight of hand first, because the either way, one of those cards is like on the top two. You know, one of the top two cards you're going to take anyway. So you would get that thing anyway, whether you put that card on the, you left that scry on the top or the bottom. And then after you sleight of hand, then you can scry and then you can dig to another card. So you have to be very careful with combo decks, and you need the right sort of mind for those." And then there are aggro players. You know, some people just like to be aggressive. They want to get the creatures in the red zone, and they're very efficient with it, and they're good with trying to recognize the window of opportunity when it's about to close, because aggro decks end up being very good very early, but then later on the game, your opponent might stabilize and then give you no chance. So you need to know when to go all in. Then there are mid-range decks. Maybe you just like to build yourself to a point where you have just a bunch of big creatures in play and you just easily attack into your opponent, like Jund and Abzan. Then there's control decks, where you need to know how to manage your resources very properly, because, you know, not all the removal spells are going to deal, or not all the answers in your deck are going to deal with every single card of your opponent. So you got to make sure that you manage these cards for those cards that match up to your opponent's deck. And then, for example, people need to hold on to Fatal Push as much as possible, because that is one of the only answers to Master of Waves, and they got to use all their other removal spells on my dinkier creatures. So, you know, there are many different types of decks. There are ramp decks, and so you got to find out which one you're capable of playing the best, and also recognize maybe which one is easier to play over others. I made a video about, you know, there are two types of control decks. There's like Tron and Grixis control, and Tron is very easy. You just play three lands and sweep the board with Ugin. Whereas Grixis control is very complicated. You got to manage your life total very well with your fetch lands and shock lands. You got to figure out which lands do you want, how to manage your cards, know when to use your life total as a resource. So if you're like a control player, but you're not so proficient yet at it, I would say, you know, go for the easier control deck, which would be Tron, and one day work your way up to Grixis control. Because, you know, maybe you like to play control, but, you know, Grixis is just incredibly complicated. I win most of my games against Grixis just because my opponent is missequencing their spells, or they're playing too many things on their main phase and not enough at the end of my turn. And Tron players, like, I can lose to a lot of novice Tron players just because the deck is so powerful and it's so redundant and there's not a lot of ways to go wrong. I guess what it comes down to is, if you're just starting out the game, and you do want to challenge yourself, but if you are just starting out, you want to play decks, I guess, that do not have as many, that don't offer too many options every single turn, because the wider range of options, the greater rate there is for error, basically.
That makes perfect sense. And I love, going through that process. Doesn't mean you have to go out and buy every single one. You can proxy them, you can borrow them, you can, like, you know, but you want to play the different styles, like you said, so you can really find out what does speak to you. It comes through experience. And sometimes it happens quickly. Sometimes, you know, you need to play a couple of times. I remember this only really ever happened once, but I assembled a deck. I forget what it was. Went to FNM. I played it. And after the night, I was like, this deck is not for me. I just knew it wasn't for me. And then it wasn't too long after that that I put together Mardu Green, I think after seeing Caleb Durwood play it. Anyway, and I played that deck. I was like, I love this deck. It spoke to me. I understood it and it just clicked. I'm like, I love this thing. And just the interactions were amazing. And so I played that for the rest of that particular standard season. And so, it takes playing and practicing, like you said, to really kind of, figure out what it is you like. And how it all works. So you kind of went into like the overarching strategy, I guess, of these different archetypes. And then you mentioned earlier about Magic Theory. So I want to dive into that a little bit. And I want to kind of piece together, you know, you talked about how there's theory in chess and there's not a lot here in Magic. Can you speak to that and kind of what's missing in Magic, what you wish we had, what you see we could have here?
Yeah, for example, okay, so I have mana up. I have, like, I don't know, 2 mana up and maybe 1 card in my hand. I attack you with 2/3/3 vanilla creatures. You are tapped out and you have 3/2/2 creatures. What is the best way to block my creatures?
Hmm. So because you have two mana up, I mean, I can either chump block both of them and save one of my dudes. I could double block one of them, but then if you have a pump spell, they're both dead. I could triple block one of them, and then, I mean, even then, if you had a giant growth, I'm still dead. So, I don't know. I guess it depends on what's in my hand and what I think I can do on the next turn.
Yeah, exactly. But this is the thing, you know, like you said, I like how you went through almost all the options, because that's what we have. That's what you really should be going through. And there are some answers that are better than others. Like, for example, if your life total is high, then obviously you shouldn't jump block either of them. If your life total is very low, let's say one, then you absolutely have to have to jump block one of them. And then we could talk about, well, let's say I don't have any pump spells in my deck. No pump spells. What's the most efficient way to block here? Let's say you're at 20 life. So I'll even more specific. You know, I have a deck that doesn't have pump spells and you're at 20 life. What is the most efficient way to block my 3/3 creatures?
We're both at 20 or?
Yeah, we're both at 20.
Okay.
Just attacked you for my first attack of 3/3s.
Yeah. So I'm thinking of the race, you know, I let you buy and you do 6 damage. And then on the swing back, I do 6 damage because I have 3 2/2s. So there's that. Or, I mean, I could double block one of them. It dies. I lose one. The other one gets by. And then on the next turn, assuming, you know, board stays the same, I can double block the other one. I mean, you wouldn't attack, obviously, but I would double block the other one. I lose another one. And now you have nothing and I have a 2/2 left.
Yeah, so that's one option. But I started this off saying I have one card in hand.
Oh, that's right.
And I have some mana. I have some mana up.
That's right. So you could play something else post.
So the one thing you have to be concerned about the most is a removal spell.
Mm.
And if you double block, you put yourself in danger of me just using a removal spell in one, and you get 2 for 1 there. So the best block is actually just throwing all 3 of them at one of them. And even if I do use a removal spell on one of those creatures, it will still be a 1-for-1 trade, because one removal spell will eat one, and I still have, you still have 2 2/2s blocking my 3/3, and I can only trade that 3/3 with one of them. And it's stuff like this that doesn't exist in Magic. How to make proper blocks, what to think about when you want to block. And this is just very simple theory, for example. I don't know if it exists anywhere. I don't see it, and I don't really hear anyone talk about it. And it's really mundane stuff that over time you sort of figure out on your own, but it could be compiled into a book of some sort, for example, available to novice players to think about our options. Like it was good, even though that we were talking about other things, like, you know, what if you had a pump spell? You know, what are all your options? You should think. You always have time to think through every single option. But away from the table, you should be thinking about those things. You should think, well, in that game, what's the difference between chomping both, double blocking one, chomping the other? What if I triple block? What if I take it all and try to race and stuff like that? And then come to some sort of conclusion. But anyway, this is the sort of stuff that I don't think exists, that I think should exist a little bit more, in addition to a lot of other things.
Man, yeah, I love it. That's for sure. Like you said, in other competitive games, like, there's books on it, like chess, just books and books and books. Is that just because, you know, all the luck element is gone, so it's easier to have concrete examples and concrete right answers, I guess?
I think it's just because Magic has not evolved to a point where people really, really, really know what they're doing. Like, maybe this is not true. Like, because as I talk to very good players, they do know what they're doing, but no one's really put this into a book or anything like that. No one's like put it into words. And the people who really, really know what they're doing, they just sort of naturally figured out the basics just intuitively, but they don't realize that most people are not picking up these basics intuitively. They're not intuitively figuring out things like playing around cards. Playing around cards is the most powerful aspect of Magic the Gathering, and learning how to properly play around your opponent's cards gives you a significant advantage, more than actually having, you know, like, more than actually having extra cards in your hand.
You know, and that's, I never thought about that, because we always compare, you know, Magic to chess, or at least draw some similarities there, which is a huge compliment to Magic, obviously, because I didn't think about it. Like, there weren't books and books written on chess when it was only 20 years old. You know, like we've had chess for hundreds of years, and mm-hmm. you know, a lot of brain power has gone behind to articulating thoughts and strategies and theory. And yeah, Magic's just been around for 20 years, and so there's these people who are picking it up. And people who are trying to, you know, they create content. Like you said, it's surface level deck text and stuff like that. But, and very few people that, you know, go deep and, you know, every now and again you see an article of somebody who's trying to put theory to words and stuff like that. But you're right. Like compared to chess, it's only been around 20 years. Chess has been around for hundreds. And so there's a lot more brain power behind chess than Magic. But I think that's really interesting. I never thought of it like that before. That's awesome. Ah, man. Good stuff. Good stuff. Now, everyone's journey through Magic or with Magic is unique. We all have highs and lows, but those highs and lows are different for each player. So we would love to dive into two stories. The first one being your worst Magic moment. And what did you learn from that experience?
Oh, my worst Magic moment? I guess the one that sticks out to me is when I was playing Mono Blue Devotion in Standard, I was just tearing up like the local game store scene, and I was winning a lot online and would make top eight and like premier events online. And I was very comfortable with this deck. But when I would go to PTQs, I ended up being like it just came down that I just ended up getting thrashed. And the last PTQ I played with Mono Blue Devotion, I lost every game. I played that tournament out to the end, and I lost every single game. And what it just reinforced is, I learned sort of these lessons with poker in that there is an element of luck to it. And I didn't feel good about that day when I lost every single game, but I knew in the back of my mind that, you know, I was still a very, very good player. And it just wasn't my day. The cards didn't run out the way that I wanted them to. I had enough results, you know, online and in the past that this tournament wasn't going to discourage me or anything like that. But just reinforce, you know, on any given day, you know, Lady Luck can like rip you apart. And I don't want to always blame luck, because I look at my past and, you know, I had very, very good results in my past, you know. So I couldn't just like, I don't want to use luck as an excuse. Oh, I got unlucky. And maybe I didn't play very well. You know, maybe I was very, very tired. Maybe I was, because for, you know, for these tournaments, I'm a night owl, and for these PTQs, they make you start at like really, really early in the morning. So for all I know, I didn't play very well in addition to that. But it was, yeah, it was a pretty, pretty disastrous day. But I would say that, yeah, on any given day, you're at the mercy of your cards. You really are at the mercy of your cards, and you just have to accept that in this game. You just have to. A lot of people go to Grand Prix thinking, "Oh, I'm going to do so well," but it's still going to come down to, you know, how well you. There is still an element to how well you got to play well, but you know you have to draw well as well.
Now, looking back on that experience, what about it made you a better Magic player?
Maybe it just made me a more humble Magic player. But I wouldn't say it made me a particularly better Magic player. I just kept going on what I was doing. It's important to be humble. It's very important to be humble. You know, I've lost a lot of games. You know, as much as I've won, I've still lost a ton. And I'll continue to lose a ton. I don't understand Magic players who get so upset for losing a single game. Like, I know so many good players. They've won a billion games of Magic, and they lose this one, and they get so upset, and they're getting angry at their opponent. I'm like, what are you doing? It's not like this is the first time you've ever lost a game of Magic, or is it?
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a very good point. On the flip side are our highs and proud moments. So what has been your proudest Magic moment to date?
Oh, it was at the Grand Prix. That was amazing. That was just an accumulation of everything I've sort of worked towards. Yeah, like I had so many people cheering me on. Like I watched the Twitch chat, and Raptors fans got completely drowned by my fans. I made Raptor look like a nobody, and so many people were cheering me on. So many people were happy to see Merfolk on the top level, and I was actually really happy that I played against a lot of tough players this tournament. Looking back, I ended up playing a lot of strong players. And one by one, got through all of them all the way to the finals, where I eventually succumbed to Josh Utter Layton in three games.
Oh, man. That's still incredible. That's absolutely incredible. And what did it mean for you? What did it feel like to have that finish?
It was really good, because it proves that there is a strong element of experience in Modern. I have so much experience with this Merfolk deck, and it is worth a lot of weight, even at a competitive level. And so many of these pros have completely scrubbed off Merfolk as a joke, and I'm going to remind them that it's not. And it's sort of like, it's just extra proof that it's not. We've already had two Grand Prix victories, so they can't say this is complete nonsense. And I was very close to a third, even at its lowest moment, at its completely lowest. We're so close to, I don't know, being less than 1% of the metagame.
Wow. And that's awesome. That is really, really cool. It feels like it was very validating and vindicating as a Merfolk player. So that's awesome. That's awesome. Now, I always like to dive into what did the preparation look like, you know, for you to make it to the top eight. And we've talked a lot about that. You've been playing, you know, Merfolk for years and whatnot. But did you do anything specific leading up to this particular event that you felt was particularly beneficial? Or in general, do you have any preparation tips when you have a big event coming up that you can share with us?
Most important thing, okay, well, there's two things that I like to do. The first one is I want to play in competitive leagues online. That is going to be very telling about what's going to be at that tournament. Because the better players, at some point or another, you have to fight through the better players. And those better players are going to make day two. And a lot of those better players are preparing online. So when I start playtesting in competitive leagues on the internet, that's going to give me a very good idea what the metagame, at least on day two, is going to be at the tournament. And I unfortunately didn't have a lot of time to prepare online. I was very busy with university, but I did end up facing a lot of Burn, Bushwhacker Zoo, Ad Nauseam, and I faced against some Coco decks. What else did I face against?
I said, my hero. I like Coco decks.
Oh, yeah?
So I mentioned that Bogles was my first one. You know, it was very, like you said, I started with a deck that didn't have a lot of decisions. You know, I do my thing, you do your thing. If I get there, great. But, you know, quickly ran into the problem of, I don't have hardly any answers. And I don't like that feeling, like just having no interaction with my opponent at all. And so, long story short, I really like Josh McClain. I saw him play, you know, the Abzan company deck, and even just watching him, it spoke to me, you know? And so like, I love the toolbox idea. I love having answers. I love being able to go, you know, fetch stuff at instant speed to answer your whatever. And so I'm putting together an Abzan Coco, you know, Court of Calling Coco deck or whatever. And so, you know, when you say that, I'm like, oh good, somebody's up there doing the thing. So anyways, go on. Sorry. You practice online with competitive leagues.
Yeah, I got an idea of what the metagame was looking like because I was playing with a list that was old. It did very well for me in a PPTQ and in an online PTQ. So I had a lot of confidence with it, but it was ending up getting in a lot of trouble against these red decks. And I was facing against a little bit too much combo in the form of Ad Nauseam, and I was struggling against that. So I got with those decks in mind, I decided to throw. Oh, and Death Shadow Zoo was becoming a very big deck online. So I could look at MTG Top 8 and see what were the big decks, what were the successful decks, things like Eldrazi Tron and Death Shadow Zoo. So I decided that the cards that I wanted to play with that weekend were going to be Tidebinder Mage. That was a switch I made at the last second. And Dispel, that would help me shore up the Burn matchup and the Ad Nauseam matchup. And I decided to make a last second switch to, I think, Dismember. Somehow I thought that was going to help me against the Eldrazi Tron deck, but I'm not entirely sure. I remember online, it just felt comfortable to play with Dismember over, say, Vapor Snag. And the Merfolk deck needs to get in that preparation because it's a very flexible deck in that you can change a lot of the cards to build it towards a certain metagame, but you better have the deck built properly because otherwise the cards might not line up very well against your opponents. Like in the past, like my former build did not have Tidebinder Mage. It was playing Spell Pierce, not Dispel. And then if you just run into this into the wrong decks, then those cards can end up being like useless. Or you can play Tidebinder Mage in a metagame where there's no green creatures or red creatures, and then that card is useless.
Yeah, I love going through that process. And thank you. I love how you recognize that, you know, day two, you're going to be playing against good competitive players and they're probably practicing online. So you went there to practice your craft and hone it. And then you're very cognizant of, okay, what am I seeing? And then what answers, what can I put in my deck? What can I swap out that address those situations and have a wide range of effectiveness, like you talked about at the top of the show. And that's a really good process to go through. So thank you so much for sharing that.
Oh, and Grixis Control. Yeah, I was also expecting Grixis Control. But in general, like if you want to prepare for a Grand Prix, I think it's just good to play against the best players in the world on a regular basis, and that's why I play in competitive leagues. And even if you and if you're getting thrashed in competitive leagues online, they've got a nice hierarchy where you can play in. You can play for free, and those players will be, you know, a certain, like, somewhat easy play level. And then you can graduate yourself to friendly leagues, which have semi-competitive people, but not too competitive. And then if you can beat that, then you can, like, move to competitive leagues.
Okay, that's cool. I did not know that that's how... I'm woefully unfamiliar with Magic Online. You know, I basically play Sealed League with some of the Prodigies every set or whatever. So I did not know that. So there's a free, friendly, and then competitive league that you can kind of work your way up?
Yes, and it is definitely where I cut my teeth on it, because you do, if you want to see, like, if you have any hopes of going to the pro tour, you need to play against good players on a very regular basis, and playing at your FNM once a week is just not going to cut it, especially when you need a lot of especially for modern, where you need a lot of experience, unless you have a local scene where there's three modern tournaments you can go to every week, then that probably compensates. But it needs to be, like, pretty, pretty often. And the second most important thing I think I prepared for this tournament is I made sure I slept. I think it's really important that you get a very good night's rest, because even if you're young and you think, oh, I'm not going to be tired tomorrow, I can just sleep for 5 hours, your brain is just not going to work like you think it's going to work. In every single game that uses your brain, you need to be in physically good condition, and you need to be well-rested if you're going to make high-quality plays. You're not allowed to make any mistakes as much as possible.
So through the years and in your vast tournament experience, what has been the biggest mistake that you see players make?
Biggest mistake that I see players make? It's hard to put. Like, maybe they just don't play around. They don't play around anything. That's probably the single most biggest mistake. They're not considering what I have in my hand. That I've got like two mana up and I have five cards in my hand, and they play like I'm tapped out and I have no cards in my hand. You have to think about worst case scenarios if you can afford it. Like if everyone's at a healthy life total, you got to think, okay, assuming he's got this really bad card, what is the best way I can attack? Or assuming he's got this really bad card, what's the best way I can cast my spells? And when you do that, you much more effectively play around your opponent's cards and you get the most value out of your own cards. I think playing around your opponent's spells is the most important aspect of Magic that goes completely ignored by the more novice players. Think about worst case scenarios always.
I was going to say that. So, like, how do we avoid that mistake? And so it's, you know, being familiar with the meta, obviously, with what decks you're going to match up. Because if you have no idea what your opponent's playing, then you have no idea what they could have. You can't play around it. So you got to be familiar with it. And then you need to just actively think about it. What's the worst case scenario? And, you know, if they have it, what does that look like? And what do I do right now to mitigate that? So, you know, and that might take the form of, you know, waiting a turn so you can, you know, cast your thing while having counter magic up, or maybe it's, you know, whatever happens to be for your deck, for your scenario, not committing because if they have a board wipe, you're screwed, or whatever happens to be, you got to consider what's the worst case scenario, and then how can I move around or maneuver around that. So that's awesome. Good stuff.
And then it can go to another level where you're playing around those things, but you have enough experience to realize that if you do play around those things, you lose anyway. And it just so happens if you don't play around those things, you will win slightly more, even if you get blown out. But that just comes down to experience. But by default, I think people should be playing around more things than they actually do.
How are you on deck building, Jonathan? Are you consider yourself a strong deck builder? Or?
I'm consider myself a strong deck tuner. I don't think I'm a very good deck builder from scratch, but I think that if I get a tier one deck in my hands, that I'm very good at tweaking it to perfection. I'm very happy with that. I've tweaked a lot of decks to very good success. Like when I was playing with Mono Blue Devotion, eventually I figured out four rapid hybridization was just a bomb in my deck. It was so, so powerful. And I was the only person, I think, on the earth that was doing this. What else? And yeah, and with Merfolk, I'm just a tweaker. I'm not really the inventor of this deck. Petr Sokrik was the inventor of modern Merfolk as it's seen today. I've just been... Well, formerly, when he was making lists, I was just tweaking them to my own preferences. And now he's abandoned Merfolk, and now the onus is completely on me to make sure that I'm carrying the flag. He's abandoned the flag.
Oh, man. So when you do these tunings, are you able to do that off of evaluating, you know, the meta, just off of kind of reviewing deck lists, or does it come after hours of playing and all that stuff?
It's mostly from reviewing the meta.
Awesome.
I can make pretty good judgment calls without actually picking up the card. But there are some cards now I'm trying to play test that require play testing, like Gemstone Caverns. I'm trying to test out this Gemstone Caverns card. It's a land where if you're on the draw, you can put it into play immediately and at the cost of discarding a card from your hand. And it's possible that this card is better than Aether Vial, but I actually have to play with this card more. I played it in sort of a joke deck, a budget version of Merfolk, because Aether Vial is like $50 and Gemstone Caverns is nothing in comparison. And it turned out really well. Like, it actually turned out really well, even though I never got this card on the draw. Just having this random land in my hand helped me curve out my deck a lot better than when I did with Aether Vial. Aether Vial is actually quite slow. It's incredibly slow. Like, Burnfolk's biggest problem is surviving to turn four, and turn three and four is the moment when you start getting some use out of Aether Vial. But at that point, it could be too late.
Interesting.
So I want to try out something with that gets lands in play. So that requires actually playing with the card. But there's a lot of cards people just mention, and I try to think, like, what do I want this card for, and how does it help me? So someone might say, well, bring in Pithing Needle against Jund to help with Liliana. And then I just try to look at their deck, like the Jund deck list, and see how they can interact with this card. And, well, if it's a problem, they can Thoughtseize or Inquisition it out of my hand. If it hits the board, it can get Abrupt Decayed or Colligan's Commanded. So I don't actually think that this is a good card against Jund, because they just have too many answers. So my answer to them is, like, I don't need to playtest the card. My opponent's cards naturally beat it. So it's I always try to look for cards that fight on an axis that my opponents can't defeat.
That is good stuff. Very good stuff. So where can we find you in the future? What events will you be going to?
I'm going for sure, or 99% for sure, to Grand Prix Las Vegas. So I'm definitely going to be there. And then maybe I'm going to play one of the Modern Grand Prix right before that. I think there's something in May. And I'll look forward to that. I don't know which one, though. I think there's one in Japan. There's one in Copenhagen. I don't know if there's one in North America, but I will probably be going to something.
Excellent. That's awesome. Absolutely awesome. How many pro points do you have this season?
Oh, I have no idea. I don't care. I probably have 7 or something like that. I don't really count the pro points. I'm not really all that interested in the pro tour or anything like that.
Oh, okay. So you're not making a run for silver or anything?
No. I'm more interested in YouTube than I am in than joining the Pro Tour.
Okay, very cool.
All they do is play draft and standard. That's no fun for me.
That's a good point. Like, your love interest is with Modern and Merfolk, so.
Yeah, that's right. You know, my friend at the end of the Grand Prix at Grand Prix Vancouver, he says, "So you're going to the Pro Tour?" And I said, "No, I'm not going to the Pro Tour. All they do is play draft and standard. I'm to hell with that." And as I'm saying that, you know, Josh Arda Layton is sort of looking at, or staring at me weird from behind.
Yeah, yeah.
This guy's fighting for the Pro Tour.
Yeah, yeah, no kidding. So you're not going to attend the Pro Tour that you qualified for?
Would you know what I'm going to do? Well, there's some things working against it. Like, I had already booked a vacation over this 3 weeks over this period.
Right.
Which is making it awkward. So I could still maybe make it work, but what it's going to come down to is I'm going to try this Blue-White Spirits deck, because that's going to play the closest to Merfolk, and I'm going to see if I can make this thing competitive. And if I can, then I will start considering going to the Pro Tour, because I really don't like... Huh?
Yeah, and then you can say, then you're going to start considering it.
Yeah, then I'm going to start considering it, because I really don't like draft.
Okay.
I really don't like I just don't enjoy that part of the game. Because I don't feel like it's a game. I like Modern and Legacy because there's so many decks, there are so many cards, and there are so many options. And I really like the mental challenge of it all. But drafting isn't the most important part of draft. Isn't the actual playing of the game? It's just the selection of cards. This is the by far the most important part of draft. And then after you've gotten your cards, then playing the game out is more or less a formality. There's a lot of these guys, a lot of these pros, I'm not certain, but I think a lot of these pros, they just sort of play the games out. The game states aren't all that complicated for them, and they more or less play pretty close to perfect. And it just comes down to if for example, my deck is better than yours. Let's see if it's actually going to win 60% of the time.
Got it. Interesting. Very interesting. Well, as we wrap things up, prodigies out there, I want to remind you, if you want to connect with Jonathan, the best place to do that is online. He's on Twitter. You can find him at NikachuMTG. He's also on Facebook. And then, of course, check out his NikachuMTG YouTube channel for more of him and the content he puts out there. So, Jonathan, what is one last parting piece of guidance you have for us? Either something you've already said you want to emphasize or something new you want to leave with us here at the end.
Never resign. That's a pretty big common mistake people do. Don't resign until people have turned their cards sideways and have beaten you. You never know when they're going to try to play around something and not actually attack you for lethal, even if you think you're completely dead. They will play around cards that may not even be in your deck and that you're not even thinking about. And so when you resign early, you are giving up games that you shouldn't.
Well, Jonathan, I want to acknowledge you for your contributions to the multiverse. And thank you so much for your time, for sharing your experiences with us today. You are a hero among planeswalkers, and it has been a blast chatting with you. May you never be mana screwed. Always draw what you need and depart every plane victorious.
That definitely happened at Grand Prix Vancouver.
Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us. That was amazing, amazing, amazing. I loved it. Prodigies, of course, you know, you can get the show notes at mtgpro2.com/Jonathan Zacek, Z-A-C-Z-E-K, and you'll find a synopsis of everything that we talked about, as well as links to any resources that were mentioned. I do want to give another thank you to the patrons and remind everyone that it's because of these noble-hearted wizards that the show does go on. The show notes and the editing is completely covered by them. So thank you, thank you, thank you. I really appreciate it. There is more that goes on behind the scenes of a podcast that I had no idea before I got into it, but at least these two big things are covered. So thank you, thank you, thank you. With your further support, we can move this brand forward, onward, and upward, all with the goal of helping you get better at Magic. So thank you so much for listening to the show. I really hope that you enjoyed it. I look forward to the many guests that we have coming up and sharing those with you as well. So stay tuned. Have a fantastic weekend. Hope you get out there and play some Magic. And until next time, I'm Sean of the Gathering, and we will see you in the next cast.
This round of MTG Pro Tutor is over. So you don't miss a single episode of MTG Mastery. Be sure to subscribe to the show on your preferred podcast listening service for more exclusive interviews, deck building tips, and elite content. Or visit mtgprotutor.com to stream it straight from the source. We look forward to helping you think and play like a pro.